This is the Historians Podcast, and I'm Bob Cudmore. We welcome back to the podcast David Fisk. How you doing, David?
Oh, I'm doing fine.
I was amazed. Well, I was amazed, but I was intrigued looking up. I think you've been our most frequent guest on Historians Podcast. You always seem to come up with great topics. I remember, I think the last one we did was about the man that swam from either from Albany to New York City or vice versa.
Right, the legless Charles Zimmy.
Yeah, Charles Zimmy, and who does not have any did not have any legs, but he did that incredible feat. Well, now I think we're going to a topic that perhaps you're best known for. David Fisk is from Saratoga County, and he was lead co-author of a book on Solomon Northup. Solomon Northup was a free black man from upstate New York who was captured and enslaved in 1841. And what David and the others wrote was the book Solomon Northup, The Complete Story of the Author of 12 Years a Slave. And the Northup story became a motion picture. David Fisk's co-authors, not to neglect them, were Clifford Brown and Rachel Seligman. And David Fisk was previously senior librarian at the New York State Library in Albany. And David's going to be talking to us about an enslavement case similar to Solomon Northup involving an African-American named Eli Terry. He'll be speaking on that topic at Solomon Northup Day at the Willsboro School in Willsboro, New York. His talk will be Saturday, July 20th at 4 p.m., sponsored by the North Country Underground Railroad Association. They'll have other speakers from the Underground Railroad History Project in Albany on the same program. The man that David is going to tell us about is Eli Terry, who was Indiana's Solomon Northup. Can you give us an account, David, of Eli Terry's story?
Yes. Well, after the film 12 Years a Slave came out, I would see a lot of comments by people about how terrible it was that something like that happened to a man. And it turned out, in the course of my research, I found numerous cases of people who were kidnapped and sold into slavery, or at least attempted to be sold into slavery. And I was struck by the case of Eli Terry because it has so many similarities to Northup's case. He left home on an offer of employment. He ended up being sold as a slave in the South, was a slave for a number of years until some people back home got word of where he was, and they made an expedition to go to the Deep South to find him, and got him released from slavery and then brought home.
Wow.
So it was very similar to Solomon Northup's case.
All right. Well, let's kind of walk through a little more in detail. Where was he from?
He lived near Indianapolis in Indiana. His father had been a free person of color in North Carolina, but had moved his family to Indiana. And in October 1842, Eli Terry, and I should point out, too, there was a different Eli Terry that was a clockmaker from Connecticut that shouldn't be confused with this Eli Terry.
Okay.
They just happen to have the same name.
Right.
So this man named James Carter wanted to go to Missouri with some horses that he wanted to sell there, and he hired Eli Terry to go with him to assist him. And they went to Missouri, were there for close to a year with Eli Terry doing various things for Carter, apparently, until finally Carter said, okay, it's time to go back home. So they started back, and he gave Eli Terry a horse and a saddle and so forth as payment for having assisted him in this work. So they started for home, and then at some point, Terry noticed that they weren't headed in the direction of Indiana.
Mm.
And so he pointed this out to Carter. He said, well, I know that, but I wanted to go visit my brother who lives down this way. So they ended up in Clarksville, Texas, which is where he understood his brother was at the time. And they were staying at an inn, and Carter went to town and came back, and he took the horses away. So Eli Terry first thought, oh, great, now how am I going to get home because I don't have a horse anymore? But then another man came out and told Terry that he had purchased him from Carter and that he was now his slave and took him back. And although Terry protested that he wasn't, that he was a free person, it wasn't really paid attention to. Now, Terry did try to run away several times, apparently, because he knew he was free, but nobody would listen to him. But he was always recaptured. So, unfortunately, he was a slave in the state of Texas. And although after he had disappeared or hadn't come back home, people tried to find out what happened to him, and they didn't have any luck back in Indiana. But years later, in 1849, a lawyer from Indiana happened to go to New Orleans on some business. And while he was there, he fortuitously ran into another man who was actually from Clarksville, Texas, who told him about this black man from Indiana who was being kept as a slave on the plantation next to his, but that he had always argued that he wasn't a slave.
And he brought that up because, because the guy said, oh, I'm from Indiana or something like that.
It was described as just a casual conversation that they had. So anyway, this lawyer went home and spread the word, and some people in the Indianapolis area, especially people that were Quakers, raised some money and sent a group of men down to Texas to try to find Terry and to bring him back. They went armed with a whole bunch of paperwork proving that Eli Terry was actually a free person. And they got to Clarksville and were able to, the original man that had tipped off the lawyer had moved away from Clarksville, but they were able to figure out where Terry was. Now, Terry had been given the name Jack because, as happened with Salma Northup, kidnapped victims were actually often given different names so that if anybody came looking for him, they would have trouble finding him. So he was called Jack in Texas. But they found him, and they went to court and started legal proceedings to get him freed. And he was taken into protective custody by the sheriff. A process is called sequestration, which was happened in a number of kidnapping cases. They would take someone into protective custody so that the person that was claiming to own them couldn't, you know, suddenly make them disappear or get rid of them or something like that until the case could be resolved. So they went to court, and the judge was pretty good. He had Eli Terry in there, and he told him, he says, look around the courtroom and see if you recognize anybody that you know from Indiana. So Terry did, and he saw one of the men whose name happened to be Paris Harrison, and he said, oh, there's Mr. Harrison, and he knows I'm free. So that was a kind of a key piece of evidence. And then the judge questioned him quite a bit, and finally the judge said, well, I'm convinced that he's as free as I am. But there was a little bit of a complication because there was another man who had a financial interest in Terry as a slave, and he was out of town, so they had to wait a week until that person came back so he could have his say. And eventually the judge decided that, you know, Terry should be released and he was free to go do whatever he wanted to. But one of the men involved as the owner of Terry threatened to appeal that decision. So the men that were with Terry from Indiana told him that if he filed an appeal, that they were going to bring a suit against him for damages because Terry had been made a slave and had been beaten during his time as a slave, but that if the man dropped his claim and dropped the appeal, that they would, you know, agree not to press any civil suits against him. So he decided that was the safest thing for him to do. So they all headed back to Indiana, and Eli Terry was restored to his family. His father especially was overjoyed to see him come back because it had been like basically 6 years or so since he'd been gone.
Mm-hmm. And I remember from the Solomon Northup case that what happened after, to some extent, is a mystery. Or I know I'm getting off Eli Terry for a moment. We don't know, for example, the circumstances of Solomon Northup's death, or do we?
We still don't know anything precise. We know that after he wrote his book, he went traveling around and giving lectures throughout the Northeast and even into Canada. And he was doing that as late as 1857. And in the early 1860s, there's evidence that he was involved in the Underground Railroad over in Vermont for a couple of years. He was working with a Methodist minister there and also another black man named Tabs Gross to get people to Canada through Vermont. Mm-hmm. And then after the 1860s, we don't really have any firm information. There's different theories that people have, but there's not really evidence mm-hmm. to back it up.
What happened to Eli Terry, or do we know
that? Well, I'm not 100% sure, but there was afterwards, there was a man by that same name in Indianapolis who had a company called the Indianapolis Coffin Company. And I can't find in any like census records any white person named Eli Terry that it would have been. And the only person I can find from Indianapolis with that name is the Eli Terry that was kidnapped. So I think that he probably was the same Eli Terry that after he came back started a company to manufacture coffins. But it's not completely sure, but as I say, I can't find any evidence of anyone else in that area named Eli Terry.
So you don't know if he had offspring up in Indiana?
Well, there's somebody, strangely, there's somebody that probably was a relative of him or maybe his son or something who was recorded living in Clarksville, Texas, but had been born in Indiana. And it's kind of curious, why would his relative go down to Clarksville where he's held as a slave? But somehow there's a story there yet to be told. But it's, as you can imagine, it's unusual in that time period to have people living in Texas who've been born in Indiana.
Yeah.
So I think that somehow it was related, but I couldn't piece together what the whole story was.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with David Fisk, author and researcher, about a subject of a talk he's going to give on a man named Eli Terry from Indiana, an African-American who was free, but who, when he took a job and went down to Texas, was enslaved for a number of years. Back with David in just a moment. Do want to mention that we depend on your contributions to keep the Historians Podcast in operation. You can donate through our GoFundMe page. Go to GoFundMe.com/2019-the-historians. Or you can make out a check to me, Bob Cudmore, and send to Bob Cudmore, 125 Horstman Drive, Scotia, New York, 12302. And thank you very much. Our guest is David Fisk from the Ballston Spa area, speaking with us on an enslavement case similar to Solomon Northup. And he wrote extensively about the Solomon Northup case, but the case we're discussing is that of a man from Indiana named Eli Terry. Were you able to do this? What resources did you find that allowed Eli Terry's story to be told?
Well, the most important one was a little booklet that was published in 1851 written by one of the men that went to rescue him. And it's very obscure. The only place I could find that had a copy of it was the Indiana Historical Society. This is back when I was researching a book I wrote called Selma Northup's Kindred, about other people that were kidnapped and sold into slavery. And they made a copy of it and sent it to me so I could read it. So it gives quite a few details. Strangely enough, the book, probably 70% of the book, is just about the trip to Texas from Indiana, and not that much about the Eli Terry's actual case. And another strange thing is that they don't really, except for in the title, it really doesn't refer to Eli Terry by name. The author just keeps talking about him as the Negro, which is kind of odd, I think. But it was his name was Thomas W. Council that did the booklet.
Mm-hmm.
But there were also some reports in Quaker publications, because the Quakers were involved in a lot of these kidnapping cases and trying to get people freed. And so that was one of the resources for my book, was various materials published by the Quakers in those days. And then because, like in this case, because there was a court trial, I was able to get some of the records of the court case to help untangle some of it. And as well as newspaper reports. And one thing that's interesting about Eli Terry's case is that afterward, now, as I mentioned, it was reported that he had tried to escape from slavery several times,
mm-hmm.
and told people that he wasn't a slave. And I always say the man who met the lawyer in New Orleans knew that Terry had claimed he was free because he told somebody else about it. But in the local newspaper afterwards, they raised suspicions that Terry had been involved in this scam and had conspired to get himself sold with the idea of sharing in some of the profits. And they said, why didn't he ever tell anybody he was a free man? I said, well, I don't know why they say that, because it was obvious that he had told people he was a free man. He tried to run away, and this man that told the lawyer about it knew that he had claimed he was a free man. But the newspaper, I guess, wanted to try to reduce their local liability in what had happened. So they said he had tried to sell himself. And they made the same argument about Selma Northup. When Northup was rescued, they stopped in Washington, D.C. and found the slave trader who had purchased him back years before and brought him up on charges. And again, the newspapers at the time in the Washington, D.C. area claimed that, well, Northup was one of these smart guys who, you know, would collude to get themselves sold and then run away and then go partake in the profits afterwards. And that story was brought up again years later when Northup found the two men who had lured him away from Saratoga and brought them to trial in Saratoga County. And again, there was a newspaper report that says, eventually the charges were dropped for whatever reasons after the case had kind of lingered for several years. But there was a report in the newspaper that says, oh, it was suspected that the reason the case was dropped was because Northup had participated in the kidnapping and allowed himself to be kidnapped with the idea of getting money out of it. So, and I found some other cases too where that argument was made, and I really found no firm cases where anybody ever conspired to have themselves sold into slavery. You know, it would have been really risky, because you don't, especially if you ended up in the Deep South, your chances of running away and getting back to the North were pretty slim because of the distance and because of all the people that were watching for runaway slaves down there. So I think it was really just a story that was made up so that people in the localities could feel better about themselves as well. He wasn't really kidnapped right. and a slave. He just allowed himself to be kidnapped.
Now, when Eli Terry left Indiana with this James Carter, I mean, you suppose he knew, or maybe you don't know, whether he knew this was going to be for so long? I mean, even just the length of time it took them to get to Missouri, right, with the horses?
I think he realized it was going to be a long-term thing, because it would take a while to get to Missouri. And the deal, as I found out was that once they got there, that Terry would do, they sold the horses, that Terry would do some other things for Carter. So I think he expected to be there for some length of time, but it seems that it was a while before Carter finally decided it was time to go back to Indiana, and it wasn't really up to Terry. I think it was up to Carter when they were going to come back. So I think he realized it was going to be a matter of months at least.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, he didn't expect he was going to end up in Texas.
No.
And on the way to Texas, too, Carter had told him, says, "Well, look, we're coming to Texas now, and they're not used to free black people here. So the best thing for you is just if anybody asks, just tell them that you're my slave, because it'd be simplify things." And that sometimes would happen. They would, in some of these other cases I've had, get the person to say that they were slave in front of witnesses, and then it's pretty hard afterwards for the person to back off and says, "Well, I'm really not a slave. I was a free person." And people could say, "Well, then why did you say we're slave the first time?"
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of a strategy the kidnappers sometimes would use.
Now, the trip to Missouri began in 1842. At that time, was Indiana a slave state, or it had legal slavery in Indiana?
I don't think so in Indiana, but I'm not 100% sure without checking into that.
But in Texas, as you just were explaining, it was a different story.
Right. They did have some of the northern states, like Indiana, did have black codes that really regulated what people of color could do, and you know, what different things. And they had to, for example, if you were a free person, you'd have to register yourself as a free person, and so that people would know, and that kind of thing. So there were a lot of restrictions in some of the states, in some of the northern states, even on what black people could do, even if they were free.
Well, even in more modern times, I mean, there are sundown towns where blacks from another community could not be seen on the streets of wherever after sundown.
Right.
Did these kidnapping cases tie in with the Civil War at all?
Yeah, they did in a couple ways. One was that in cases where kidnapped victims ended up being freed, and in some cases with the assistance of people in the slave states where they were enslaved, they would always make the point that, "Oh, well, we had a free man who was kidnapped, and we let him be released."
Mm-hmm.
But how come in the North, when our runaway slaves come up there, you don't return them the way you're supposed to, according to the Constitution and according to the fugitive slave law? So they would make that point as well. "Look, we're so good because when we find out these people are kidnapped, we make sure they get home, mm-hmm. and you don't reciprocate." And then the other aspect was that in the northern states, not everybody was necessarily against slavery. I mean, slavery was something that was kind of in the South, and it didn't always impact people directly unless they happened to have moral concerns about it. So they weren't really, not everybody was concerned about the existence of slavery. However, they didn't like the idea that a person who was free could be kidnapped and made into a slave.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of, you know, excited some people that otherwise wouldn't have been concerned about slavery, but they thought, well, we have this system of slavery, and free people can be kidnapped and made into a slave basically because of the color of their skin. And that makes me think about maybe this whole slavery system is not that good, because if free people can be made into slaves, then I don't like that. So it did help these kidnapping cases did help to bolster anti-slavery feeling in the North among people that otherwise may not have been that concerned about slavery.
David Fisk will be speaking on the case of Eli Terry of Indiana, an African-American who was enslaved in Texas when he went there with another man and kind of under false pretenses was put into slavery, as was Solomon Northup. And David Fisk will be speaking at Solomon Northup Day at the Willsboro School in Willsboro, New York. His talk will be Saturday, July 20th, 2019 at 4 p.m., sponsored by the North Country Underground Railroad Association. I'm going to put you on the spot, I guess I will. Well, can you tell us about that? What is that organization?
Well, first, before I answer that, I just want to put in a plug, too, that Solomon Northup Day was begun back in 1999 by a woman named Renee Moore, who at the time lived in Saratoga Springs. Mm-hmm. So it's been going since then. This is really about 20 years. But the North Country Underground Railroad Historical Association, they run a Underground Railroad Museum up in Sable Chasm. And they do different, they do like some little driving tours and so forth, showing areas in that, spots in that area that were related to the Underground Railroad at the, in the old days.
Mm-hmm.
And so they do different things to keep the stories of these Underground Railroad alive up there. They have different events, sometimes
yeah.
sponsors. They sometimes sponsor the Summer North of Day. Summer North of Day is not always held in the same spot, but
it's up in Willsboro.
Sponsored by them.
Okay. Are you going to write about Eli Terry? Or?
Well, he's in my book, the Summer North of Kindred book.
Okay. Oh, he is. All right.
In quite a bit of detail and with references to the sources and so forth.
Well, I mentioned that David Fisk, I think, has been our most frequent guest. He's been on Historian Podcast 9 times. And, David, I made a list. In 2014, I think you were on 4 times talking about Solomon Northup a couple of times, but also about Madame Cherie,
right.
which was a show business topic, and the Kennebec, which is up in Maine, isn't it? And
right.
And you've written about that. And also other stories about Ballston Spa, because you've been living in that area and know a lot about the history of Ballston Spa. For example, its chocolate factory, and then the book on Solomon Northup's Kindred, as you've just referenced, and the man who swam from Albany to New York City, or maybe it was vice versa. And I just have maybe enough time to ask you quickly. You're doing Songs of World War One for the soldiers and the public. These were programs of music and so forth that were put together during the war. And you're doing a couple of talks on that this summer. One of the talks will be July 14th. Another will be July 30th. Can you tell me where the two are to July 14th?
July 14th is at the Gorham Free Library that's near Geneva. And July 30th will be at the Richards Library in Warrensburg.
David, we are just out of time. I thank you very much for joining us today. You have been listening to the Historians Podcast, and I'm Bob Cudmore.